HiBridge, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Know-It-Alls, The Rise of Silicon Valley as a Political Powerhouse and Social Wrecking Ball, by Noam Cohen. Read by Adam Grouper.
Why, anybody can have a brain. That's a very mediocre commodity. Every pusillanimous creature that crawls on the earth or slinks through slimy seas has a brain.
The Wizard of Oz.
The end of man is knowledge, but there is one thing he can't know. He can't know whether knowledge will save him or kill him. He will be killed, all right, but he can't know whether he is killed because of the knowledge which he has got, or because of the knowledge which he hasn't got, and which, if he had it, would save him.
All the King's Men.
Introduction. To Serve Man.
In a memorable Twilight Zone episode, To Serve Man, aliens land on Earth. These aliens, the Canamits, 9 feet tall and topped with massive heads, say they've come in peace and intend to share their superior technology to benefit humanity. Immediately they are true to their word. Barren soil in Argentina produces grain. Mysterious force fields protect each nation's borders, rendering the nuclear arms race irrelevant. And when the suspicious Soviets raise concerns, the Canamits chief gladly takes and passes a lie detector test. A little while later, when the alien suggests that Earthlings load up in a flying saucer to see the wonders on the Canamits' home planet, few question it. There are lines to get a precious seat. The story is told in flashback through the eyes of one of those passengers, Michael Chambers, an American codebreaker assigned to decipher a manuscript accidentally left behind by the Canamit leader. A member of Chambers' decryption team succeeds in piecing together the manuscript's reassuring title, To Serve Man, and the world is confirmed in its belief that the aliens' intentions are good. Chambers rushes onto the Canamit bandwagon as one of the last passengers aboard. Yet, just as Chambers walks up the ramp of the aliens' ship, a voice below reveals the bitter truth about To Serve Man. It's a cookbook! At the end, a Canamit is heard over a loudspeaker, encouraging Chambers to be sure to eat all of his supper. This story is flamboyantly absurd science fiction. How can you crack a code without a key to work off of? And would the Canamit language really have the exact same double meaning for the phrase, to serve? Furthermore, why would aliens come all this way to harvest people instead of something truly tasty like cattle or tuna or truffles? To Serve Man, nonetheless, manages to convey an important message. It is wise to be suspicious of those who claim to pursue selflessly the prosperity of others, even as they pursue their own. Also, those dual meanings of serve may reveal a universal truth, in that purporting to act in service of others without their consent necessarily involves manipulation, grooming, and exploitation. Silicon Valley surely is unrivaled in the American economy in its claims to serve mankind. So much so, in fact, that the satirical TV show Silicon Valley has a running joke that whenever a startup founder is introduced, no matter how absurdly technical his project may be, he assures the audience that he is committed to making the world a better place. Paxos algorithms for consensus protocols? Making the world a better place. Minimal message-oriented transport layers? Making the world a better place. Yet strip away the satire, and you find that Google works from the same playbook. The company assures us that it collects and stores so much personal information about its users to better serve them. That way, Google sites can remember what language you speak, identify which of your friends are online, suggest new videos to watch, and be sure to display only the advertisements you'll find most useful. Even when Google is being paid by businesses to show you ads, it's really thinking about making your life better. Facebook similarly insists that it acts in the best interest of humanity, no matter how its actions may be perceived. For example, there is the Free Basics Project,
which provides a Facebook-centric version of the Internet for cell phone users who cannot afford access to the actual Internet. Critics in India objected to Facebook's apparent largesse, seeing the program as pushing a ghettoized, fake Internet experience for poor people, merely to keep its audience growing. Facebook's chief executive, Mark Zuckerberg, didn't back down, however, describing the dispute as a choice between right and wrong, between raising hundreds of millions of people out of poverty through even limited Internet access, or leaving them to suffer without any access at all. He made a public appeal by video, which concluded, "History tells us that helping people is always a better path than shutting them out. We have a historic opportunity to improve the lives of billions of people. Let's take that opportunity. Let's connect them." Certainly, from time immemorial, moguls have believed that their own prosperity must be good for all of society. But only the recent batch of Silicon Valley entrepreneurs have acted as if money were an unanticipated byproduct of a life devoted to bettering mankind. Mark Andreessen, the Silicon Valley venture capitalist who serves on Facebook's board, was scathing when he learned that the Indian government had sided with the critics and blocked Free Basics. The government's decision was morally wrong and punishing to the world's poorest people, Andreessen wrote on Twitter, offering yet another example of how India has been on the wrong track since its people kicked out their British overlords. "Anti-colonialism has been economically catastrophic for the Indian people for decades. Why stop now?" he asked sarcastically. Andreessen quickly apologized when he saw the furious response to those comments, particularly within India. But they nonetheless proved that he belonged among a tiny class of public figures who would have the self-assurance to make such a statement in the first place. To trash Indian democracy and self-determination in defense of their own belief systems and their own particular business models. The Know-It-Alls is the story of these powerful, uber-confident men, starting with Andreessen, who helped nurture the World Wide Web to prosperity in the 1990s before switching to investing. It ends with Zuckerberg, who has the most ambitious plans for linking the world within his own commercial online platform. Along with Andreessen and Zuckerberg, there's a bevy of tech internet billionaires, including Jeff Bezos of Amazon, Sergey Brin and Larry Page of Google, Reid Hoffman of LinkedIn, and the early Facebook investor Peter Thiel. They are a motley crew. Some, like Hoffman, are outwardly friendly, cuddly even, while others, like his good friend Thiel, cultivate an aura of detachment and menace. Some, like Brin and Page, one suspects, would prefer to be left alone with their computers, while others, like Bezos or Zuckerberg, seek the limelight. Some were born to program, others to make money. But they share common traits. Each is convinced of his own brilliance and benevolence, as demonstrated by his wildly successful companies and investments. And lately, each is looking beyond his own business plan to promote a libertarian blueprint for us all. Collectively, these Silicon Valley leaders propose a society in which personal freedoms are near absolute and government regulations wither away, where bold entrepreneurs amass billions of dollars from their innovations and the rest of us struggle in a hyper-competitive market without unions, government regulations, or social welfare programs to protect us. They tap into our yearning for a better life that technology can bring, a utopia made real. Yet one cannot escape the suspicion that these entrepreneurs may not fully appreciate what it means to be human. That is, not just to be a human individual, the unit that libertarianism is so obsessed with, but to be part of a family, a community, a society. The feminist political theorist Susan Mahler Okin argued convincingly that libertarianism requires precisely this kind of obtuseness. In the libertarian fantasy, men magically arrive at adulthood ready to remake the world. How? Raised by whom? If advocates for extreme individualism actually had to acknowledge the work and sacrifice of women to bear and nurture children, Okun contended, as well as the assistance of society in children's upbringing, their arguments would lose all force. No one would then be able to say with a straight face that whatever he has is the product of his own hard work and should be his alone to control. Behind the individualist facade of libertarianism, she concluded, the family is assumed but ignored. Once women, family, and society are pushed to the side, however, individuals are free to duke it out for life spoils, unencumbered by social obligations, as Hoffman explains in his business advice book, The Startup of You. For anything desirable, there's competition, he writes. A ticket to a championship game, the arm of an attractive man or woman, admission to a good college, and every solid professional opportunity. The only sensible response, he concludes, is to labor as a high-risk, high-reward startup of you. The conditions in which entrepreneurs start and grow companies are the conditions we all now live in when fashioning a career. You never know what's going to happen next. Information is limited. Resources are tight. Competition is fierce. The world is changing. And the amount of time you spend at any one job is shrinking. This means you need to be adapting all the time. And if you fail to adapt, no one, not your employer, not the government, is going to catch you when you fall. As the harsh world dreamed up by these wealthy, powerful Silicon Valley leaders gains traction, the know-it-alls becomes the story not just of their lives, but of ours, too. Silicon Valley never would have had the wealth and power to shape America's values had there not been a worldwide web to make computers so useful and relevant to daily life. When the British physicist Tim Berners-Lee first brought the web into existence some 25 years ago at the CERN laboratory in Switzerland, he imagined he was creating a decentralized network for people to collaborate through their computers, with commerce low among his priorities. Berners-Lee's original vision of a small-scale, almost anarchic web was shed nearly immediately as Netscape, the Silicon Valley company Andreessen co-founded after graduating from college in the Midwest, took the lead in the web's development. Netscape's early emphasis on commerce and creating a passive, user-friendly experience led the web to where it is today, wildly popular around the world, with a few companies able to apply a chokehold on how we access and use the Internet. In search, there is Google. In commerce, Amazon. In social networking, Facebook. Yet, despite its European parentage, the web would be a Bay Area baby. Vital new tools for navigating within and between sites, for searching through oodles of digital information, and for sharing opinions and photos with friends and acquaintances, all grew to maturity within Silicon Valley's startup culture. Businesses based on those tools soon directed a sizable portion of the nation's wealth toward the West Coast, as if the United States were a pool table tilted so the balls wound up in the left side pocket. The wealth that has since accumulated around San Francisco has largely gilded over its flower power reputation, leaving the city inhospitable to anyone but the highest-paid programmers who are shuttled to and from their corporate campuses on luxury buses. Street protests against those buses, which serve as a private mass transit system, have helped highlight the great wealth disparity in the Bay Area. But there have been other extravagances as well. The tech investor Sean Parker staged a multi-million-dollar wedding in a redwood forest landscape to look like Middle-earth of The Lord of the Rings. The Silicon Valley venture capitalist Vinod Khosla caused an outcry by demanding that the state pay him $30 million before he would give the public access to Martin's Beach, which sits below his property. And there was the lavish Versailles-themed 40th birthday party in Los Angeles for David Sachs, a former PayPal executive and successful startup founder, who, to his credit, at least try to stop his guests from sharing the gaudy details through social media. The consequences of Silicon Valley values went from classless to catastrophic, however, during the recent presidential election. A near majority of the electorate succumbed to Donald Trump's appeal to bring back a less convulsive past, complete with its unchecked racism and misogyny, and many of us experienced for the first time the fragility of our society after so much internet-based disruption. America in 2016 lacked the stabilizing influences of traditional news-gathering organizations and community groups, vibrant local businesses, strong labor unions, aggressive government regulations, and engaged political parties, each of which had been undercut by Silicon Valley businesses and the libertarian principles of their founders. What remained were a few distant tech giants and a collection of angry individuals, abandoned by the global economy and lashing out at remote forces, immigrants, Wall Street bankers, trade agreements, political correctness, without serious intent. Instead, these voters empowered a cynical blowhard who promised improbably, "I alone can fix it." Among the circumstances for Trump supporters to rebel against were the Silicon Valley's insta-billionaires themselves, who had helped bring about so much of the country's social disruption. The rapid rise of these young entrepreneurs sent an unmistakable signal that income inequality would only be getting worse. At the same time, the apparent requirement that a successful entrepreneur attend the right school and have the right backers revealed that the Silicon Valley startup system wasn't a meritocracy, as is so often proclaimed, but was rigged, to quote the great man himself. Take the case of the photo-sharing service Instagram, which was sold for $1 billion to Facebook barely 2 years after being launched. One co-founder, Kevin Systrom, a 28-year-old Stanford graduate, kept 40% of the proceeds of the sale, with a few prominent VC firms and early investors taking big cuts as well. At the time of the sale, in April 2012, Instagram employed all of 13 workers. How any of this could help sustain a happy, productive society was a mystery. There was a final gift from Silicon Valley during the 2016 election: the radical insistence that what was expressed on the web should be unregulated, which allowed the hate and abuse of the Trump campaign to fester and then spread. On Twitter, Trump's followers and Trump himself were permitted to intimidate critics, particularly women and minorities. This relaxed approach from Twitter was matched by Facebook and Google, which served their users made-up news about the election as long as the articles remained popular. Freedom of speech apparently trumped all other values, as Google, Facebook, and Twitter encouraged the public to stew in their own hateful juices and profited handsomely in the process. One Silicon Valley figure unafraid to explore the natural affinity between Silicon Valley values and Trump values is Thiel, who saw Trump as a Silicon Valley-style man of action and vision, a larger-than-life agent of disruption. "When Donald Trump asks us to make America great again, he's not suggesting a return to the past," Thiel explained in his speech to the delegates gathered at the Republican National Convention in Cleveland. "He's running to lead us back to that bright future." That was the point, wasn't it? To apply the winning, destructive, forward-thinking vision of Silicon Valley to the rest of America. As Thiel boasted in that same address, "Where I work in Silicon Valley, it's hard to see where America has gone wrong. My industry has made a lot of progress in computers and in software, and of course it's made a lot of money. But Silicon Valley is a small place. Drive out to Sacramento, or even just across the bridge to Oakland, and you won't see the same prosperity. That's just how small it is." Imagine if everything in the American economy worked like Silicon Valley. This was the glorious future Thiel saw in a Trump presidency. Thiel's high-profile endorsement of Trump certainly raised the hackles of his peers, who generally supported Hillary Clinton for president, seeing her as the continuation of the Obama administration's Silicon Valley-friendly policies on immigration and internet regulation. But Thiel was also an outlier for being so high-profile in his support during the election, which included $1.25 million in donations to a Trump-affiliated super PAC and the Trump campaign itself. The founders of internet startups, like entertainers or professional athletes, aspire to be popular with all sorts of people and are quick to play down political differences. They claim to be focused on efficiency, not ideology. Elon Musk, who started as a web entrepreneur before founding the electric car company Tesla, captured this non-political, political perspective in a post to Twitter in 2012. "I'm neither anti-conservative nor anti-liberal. Just don't like groupthink. Ideas should be considered on their own merits." Even Thiel himself later sought cover from some of Trump's more extreme ideas, a wall with Mexico, mass deportations, by saying he and other supporters took Trump seriously, but not literally. The libertarian tilt of the know-it-alls has been of great assistance as they pursue a version of non-political politics. Libertarianism can be framed as moderate and open-minded, that is, I agree with liberals on some issues, like gay rights or abortion rights, but agree with conservatives on others, like tax cuts or shrinking the social safety net. Similarly, the libertarian can say even-handedly that though the left may hate it, he believes in absolute freedom of speech, and though the right may hate it, he believes in letting people smoke marijuana if they want to. This approach fits someone like Jeff Bezos, for example, who has donated to a campaign to legalize gay marriage in Washington state, as well as one to defeat a ballot initiative that would have introduced an income tax on millionaires in the state. Bezos, who now owns the Washington Post, has also supported the foundation that publishes the libertarian magazine Reason. Some observers have labeled Bezos a libertarian, a liberal libertarian, which is a term that could apply to many Silicon Valley leaders who travel in Democratic Party circles but oppose unions, hate speech codes, or expanded income redistribution. And isn't this the rub, really, of any book trying to explain the political influence of Silicon Valley leaders? So much of what they are advocating comes at you sideways, or is described not as a belief but as an inevitable turn as society matures technologically. Yet there is, of course, a distinct Silicon Valley belief system. As we've seen, it advocates for a highly individualistic society led by the smartest people who deliver wonderful gadgets and platforms for obtaining goods, services, and information efficiently, freeing each of us to compete in the marketplace for our daily bread. There is a particular history, too, of how those values came to be, which reflects separate but intertwined influences. First, there were the original hackers of university-run computer labs, a boys' club of programming geniuses, who were a source of the optimism and idealism of Silicon Valley, as well as its suspicion of authority and unwelcoming attitude toward women. Later came the entrepreneurs and investors congregating around Stanford University, who were able to recognize the windfall from computers once they had been improved so that ordinary people could use them. Silicon Valley's investors and entrepreneurs taught the hackers to think of the people who used their products as assets to extract value from, rather than simple folk who, through the kindness of programmers, would learn about the infinite power of computers. The hackers arrived on the scene at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology in the late 1950s, when they were first introduced to computers by a pair of junior mathematics professors, John McCarthy and Marvin Minsky. Barely in their 30s, those two had already helped chart a path toward artificial intelligence through computers, which they believed could be programmed to think as people do. McCarthy taught MIT's first freshman class in programming in 1959, and those students naturally gravitated to the computer in McCarthy and Minsky's well-funded lab, where they were granted an extraordinary level of independence, freedom, even omnipotence. These students came to be known as hackers because of how much they had to figure out on their own. When problems cropped up, they had to hack together a solution. Surrounded by their beloved machines, which seemingly only they truly understood, the hackers were permitted by McCarthy and Minsky to live by a set of anti-authoritarian rules that made sense for a bunch of smarty-pants outsiders. The individual outranked the collective. Personal freedom was more important than empathy or compassion. Status came from programming skill, not age or grades or likability or some academic title. In sum, the hackers believed in an ethic that gave each individual the freedom to do what he wanted with his computer and to say whatever he wanted about whomever he wanted, whenever he wanted. Success or failure would be based on talent alone. Still, for all the acceptance of personal eccentricity and insistence on merit, these young men reflected a uniformity that persists in Silicon Valley to this day, starting with the fact that they were all men. Women weren't exactly forbidden to be hackers. They just weren't accommodated or made to feel welcome, and at times they faced harassment. The other source for Silicon Valley's values, the tech entrepreneurs, were spurred on by Stanford, which by the 1950s had turned itself into an explicitly pro-business research institution. The university was founded back in the late 19th century with a robber baron's multi-million-dollar bankroll. Yet, for much of that history, it lagged behind the great institutions back east. By the mid-20th century, Stanford was stumbling along, known for educating the children of the middling rich of Los Angeles. During this mediocre era, the school's ambitious engineering school dean, Frederick Terman, was given broad powers as university provost and vice president to make Stanford great. A specialist in a highly practical aspect of electrical engineering, radio waves, Terman had a proven record of turning research into business opportunities, and his plan was built on that experience. He proposed that Stanford use its resources to encourage research in areas with practical applications so that students and faculty members could help industry thrive. Surely a significant share of the wealth and status they generated would find its way back to Stanford. Under Terman's guidance, Stanford smoothed the way for researchers to partner with big business or to strike out on their own. "I used to go around and give talks to people in industry," he recalled. "My theme was always that the university is a real asset if you make use of it, industrial use. And then I would come back and beat on the backs of the professors to get out and get acquainted with those companies that were related to their research." An early example of a university-brokered business success was Hewlett-Packard, which was founded in 1939 by two of his favorite electrical engineering students, William Hewlett and David Packard. Terman, who was a professor at the time, helped Hewlett and Packard obtain their first equipment, which was initially housed in a Palo Alto garage that today is listed in the National Registry as the birthplace of Silicon Valley. He then helped them land their first large order, which was to produce equipment used for the sound editing on the Walt Disney movie Fantasia. Hewlett and Packard, in turn, became prominent donors to Stanford. The culmination of their generosity toward Stanford came in 1977, when they raised the funds for the $9.2 million Frederick E. Terman Engineering Building. Terman ultimately was instrumental in Stanford's decision to invest in the new field of computer science. But at first, he was skeptical. The business potential wasn't obvious. In the mid-1950s, computers were just fast calculators that were helpful to applied mathematicians, but to few others. The research into artificial intelligence by McCarthy, Minsky, and others, however, helped make the case for computers' broader relevance. These professors, and particularly the obsessed young hack...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?